So for the grand finale for this afternoon, we need to introduce Benson Carr, University of Chicago, who's going to tell us about biology and presentation of your building.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to speak. It's a great honor. This is a picture of Bill. I was a student of Bill's from 89 to 94. Got my PhD from Princeton, not Berkeley. I just want to make that clear. What really freaked me out is that when I found this picture of Bill, he was 45 in this picture, and I'm 46. So he just seemed like this infinitely old guy. So now I realize he was a young, promising mathematician. So I'm going to report on stuff I've been working on with Tom Church, and then Tom Church and Jordan Ellenberg, and Rohit Nagpal has joined us. It's growing in the last 3 or 4 years. And, you know, yes, I've given this talk to 20 times to people here, but not this talk. Variations, it keeps growing. And it's often called homology representation theory. So, like, I just tacked on NBIL, you might think. But I was thinking a lot about what to talk about, and I realized this talk is absolutely, I believe, like, infused with the Thurstonian spirit, the way of looking at things, which is the absolutely number one thing that Bill taught, I think, all of us, is much more importantly than any content. As Bill has said in Proof and Progress in Mathematics, it's the way of thinking. And secondly, though, I realize this talk, it has secretly has braids, it has polynomials, homology, things that Bill studied. So anyway, let me just start with the mathematics here. I want to start talking about configuration spaces and polynomials. So what I've decided to do, this is something we've been working on for several years, and it's touched a lot of different areas of mathematics. And it was hard. I've decided to demonstrate the sort of richness of the stuff I want to talk about by focusing all the way in on the very simplest example of the theory. And I want to hope to show that, like, you can find richness, a lot of richness there. So let me start the story with Tom Church, who was a student of, he was a student at Cornell. He graduated when he was 17. I think this is a picture when he showed up at my door to get a PhD. I thought he was like a prospective high school student. He learned about configuration spaces and braids at Cornell from Bill, just like I learned about them at Princeton from Bill. But anyway, so let M be a space, and let confan of M be the space of distinct n tuples of points in M, but it's ordered m tuples of distinct points. Okay, conf is for configurations. Now the symmetric group acts freely on this space by just permuting the coordinates in the obvious way. And then when you take the quotient space, it's of course the space of unordered n tuples. And these are basic spaces, not just in mathematics, they occur in science. This is what I tell my parents. You know, I'm solving problems not just about robots on a factory floor, satellites in orbit, but if I can say something about configuration spaces in topology, I can say something about every possible problem. And I actually believe that. But one example that occurs in mathematics that's been really inspirational to me, and I've continued to learn new things about it after 4 years of digging, Arnold was one of the main proponents of this, is if you look at the space of monic degree n square-free polynomials in one variable. So what I mean by, monic, you know what that means, degree n. Square-free, it's just no repeated roots. So there's a bijective correspondence with the space of configurations of n unordered points. Remember, this was unordered points with the space of polynomials, square-free polynomials. And the bijection is easy. If you give me n distinct points, I can just form this polynomial. Everything's over the complex numbers. So if you give me n distinct points, I get a complex polynomial of degree n. Conversely, a convex polynomial without repeated roots, I just mark down where the roots are. Okay? And the fact that you're distinct is exactly the square-free condition. So even just simplifying to the easiest case of configurations, it's a very rich space. And so here's, let's take a look at, here's the complex plane. let's take the space of, this is the space of four distinct points in the plane. And these points, this is the polynomial where the roots are 1, 3, minus 1, and minus 3. Okay. So there's two ways to parameterize the space of polynomials of degree 4, square-free polynomials. I'm never going to say monic again. It's always monic. You can mark down where the roots are. That's what I did there. Or you can mark down the coefficients, right? Those are two different ways of parameterizing the space. And I'm going to relate them here with this great animation by my wife. If you can't do animations, get a collaborator to do it. If you can't get that, then get your wife to do it. There. So it's a very rich thing. And I just learned a purely topological proof that you cannot solve the quintic by understanding these two different parameterizations and how they compare. Anyway, this space of polynomials of degree n is an algebraic variety. And let me do two examples that we know well. Poly 2, which is the space of polynomials z squared plus bc, bz plus c, what's the condition for a quadratic polynomial to not have roots? B squared minus 4, you know, square root of b squared minus 4c. So it's b squared minus 4c is not equal to 0, right? These are monic. What? To not have repeated roots. What did I say? Oh, yeah, to not have roots. Okay. Okay, not have repeated roots. For cubics, of the, this is the general monic cubic. And so you can parameterize them. Like up here, you parameterize it just by the coefficients, right? The parameterization, one is by marking down the roots. This is the parameterization by the coefficients. So here it's just b, c, and d. And when you write down the condition, this is the discriminant of the polynomial. And if you didn't know, I'm assuming most people know, it's this amazing fact that if you give me an arbitrary polynomial of any degree, and you want to know if you have a repeated root, you don't have to find all the roots. You just put in, there's always a polynomial in the coefficients that you put into the coefficients of your polynomial, and you check if it's zero or not, and that's going to tell you if you have repeated roots or not. Okay. So, but this shows, of course, that you're an algebraic variety, and that'll be very important for us later. Okay.
So that picture here, sorry, can you go back to the picture?
Yes, that is not an accurate picture. That's just some kind of quasi-projective variety-looking thing.
Is that the thing that is
No.
That place where it is zero? What?
Yeah, the place where it's zero. No, this picture is just a picture of, like, the kind of variety that this is. But this is the complement. Right. Well, I had pictures of slices and everything, but I was trying to save time. So the recap is we have the space of ordered n tuples of distinct points on any manifold. We're going to concentrate on the simplest manifold, just the plane, one of the simpler ones, the complex plane. And then the space of unordered tuples, because the symmetric group is acting. And these are n-point subsets. Great. And that's the polynomials. Okay. Now what? The fundamental problem I'd like to discuss, which is an old problem, is to understand the topology of the space of polynomials. In particular, compute the cohomology, which are the simplest linear invariants attached to your space. And so one basic question is, how does the topology of configurations you could do on any manifold, how does it depend on n? How does it change as you do more points? This has applications to many kinds of mathematics. And there's some beautiful paper of Smale on this, and Hilbert 13's problem. The list goes on. And we'll talk about some applications later. But I want to do this case study, especially because there's a lot of graduate students. And anyway, let me just do a case study of why we care about cohomology. What do you actually do with cohomology? So recall, let's just do H1. First, cohomology with rational coefficients, that's nothing more than homomorphisms. It's from the set of loops, from pi 1, of course, but it's really from conjugacy classes to Q. In other words, the way Bill would this really is a Thurstonian thing. The way Bill would look at like a homomorphism to Q is saying, like, oh, you're attaching to every group element a rational number. And you're doing it in an additive way, in like a reasonable way. That's what it is. That's what determining H1, or like, what are the ways you can do it? So how do you do it? You know, here's a loop. So I have to give a loop of in my space of configurations of n points. So here's space of configurations of 6 points. A loop is, the 6 points stand there, you say go, let's call, instead of numbers, I'll give them colors. You say go, and they all move around. They can't intersect each other. Whoa. Oh. Okay. Sorry, Amy Wilkinson did that too. It's really hard to make them not hit. Okay, that's a loop. Ready? Go. Give me a rational number now. Yeah, 3. Danny's got it right. That's why he's at Chicago. So here's a way to do it. Here's what you do. Here's a way to attach a number in a canonical way. Pick 2 points. Let's pick 3 and 6. Ignore all the other points, what they're doing. Perform your loop. Right? Given a loop, I have to give you a number. Okay? Well, what would, you know, this is the kind of, Bill would squint his eyes, right? And he'd go, wait, consider it, I have a camera, a video camera, and I'm looking at you. And from this point of view, blue's just moving around red. You normalize so that red's not moving. And you just mark down how many revolutions. So in other words, given a loop, we just performed a loop alpha, and we've picked 2 points. The number you attach is the winding number, is the winding number of the first point around the second point. So for any pair, I and J, I get a map from the set of loops to Q, and you can check it's an element of H upper 1. It's additive, and you just define it to be the winding number. This is a really cool thing. You know, Danny and I, if I'm moving around Danny, from my point of view, he's moving around me in the same direction. And one nice way, what Bill would say is, he would bring me and say, if you're dancing together with a partner, right, and you're moving like this, you're both obviously moving, if you're moving clockwise respect to me, then I'm moving clockwise respect to you, not counterclockwise. So the sign is like this. And again, I just want to, it's homework for everyone. I should have given it before the talk, but I will check tomorrow. Read Proof in Progress in Mathematics. I'm sure everybody's probably read this at least a few times. But one of the themes of Bill is like what it means to understand something is like level 1, level 2, and then he said, here's level 37 of derivative. And I'm finding that like just configurations of points in the plane, there's, you know, infinitely many levels. Well, I don't know if there's infinitely many, but I'm whatever. So like here's another way. That's part of the theme of this talk. So what is like W12? Look at the space of polynomials. On the space of polynomials, what is like W12? Here's what it is. Given a loop, it's a path integral. It's really fun. It's in terms of the coefficients there. Anyway, great. So we just constructed for any pair I and J an element of H upper 1. So I get n choose 2, and Wij equals Wji. So I get n choose 2 vectors in H upper 1, right?
You show us the integral again, kind of by all commands.
Yes. Yeah, it's not essential for the, it's just a fun little thing. D b squared minus 4c over b squared minus 4c. So yeah, I'll make these slides available to people. Actually, this a lot of this stuff is surveyed in a paper that is on my webpage, and I posted to the archive, and it's just called Representation Stability. Okay, so how do you prove these vectors are linearly independent? Okay, I want to give a proof for you, a kind of, you know, and again, the best proofs are like visual proofs, as sort of Bill taught us. Why can't you write, for example, W36 as a linear combination of the others? Well, ready? Here's the proof. So W36 is just assigns to a loop the winding number of 6 around 3. And I want to show you can't write that in terms of any of the other winding numbers. Ready? Here's the proof. Look at that loop. Everybody stays still and 3 moves around 6. So W36 of that loop is 1, but all the other Wijs are 0, so obviously you cannot write W36 as a linear combination of the others. Okay, questions? That's the proof. Every talk has to have a proof. So it's a really cool theorem of Arnold in 1968 that the Wij are the only ways of attaching a number. So in other words, H1 of configurations of n ordered points, distinct points in the plane, it's q to the n choose 2, it is spanned by the Wijs. Wijs are a basis. What that says is the only way to attach a number, a rational number, to a loop of configurations is just marking down how much I wraps around J, and then you can take linear combinations of those things. To me, that is what first cohomology is, right? You don't always learn that in algebraic topology class. I did from Marshall Cohen and from Hatcher and from, anyway, when I was an undergrad. They taught that, but anyway. So cohomology isn't just some naked vector space, it has meaning. Now, what is the cohomology of the space of unordered n-tuples? In other words, the first cohomology of the space of polynomials. What is it? Well, what are you looking for? You're looking for to attach to every loop of unordered n-tuples, right? You have n points, but now you're not. Before I said, pick point number 3 and point number 6. Points don't have names anymore. So how do you come up with a way to attach a number, right? Well, how about this? I just add up all the wijs. I add up all the winding numbers of everything around everything else. I number them randomly, and then I mark down all the winding numbers. I add them all up. It doesn't matter, obviously, the sum of all of them doesn't matter on how I order them. So that's an invariant, right? So H upper 1 of the space of polynomials is at least one-dimensional. And I claim that the total winding number is the only invariant for poly n, by which I mean the first cohomology with rational coefficients of the space of degree n monic square free polynomials. In other words, configurations of n unordered points in the plane, distinct points. It's Q, spanned by total winding number. How would you prove that? Well, I'm going to give you this little baby case where representation theory comes in. One of the themes of this thing is that of this talk as well, and this is something I learned in an email from Bill in 1998, that representation theory is hugely underused in at least geometric group theory and related topics. So we're going to do a pure representation theory proof where you don't have to know topology to show this topological fact that total winding number is the only measurement you can take, is the only way to attach a number. So the first cohomology of this space by transfer in topology, so the space of configurations covers this of conf, whoops, ah, sorry. Conf is a covering space of configurations mod the symmetric group, right? And the symmetric group acts, and so it acts on the cohomology. And what transfer says in topology, because we're with rational coefficients, says that it's the fixed vectors, the vectors fixed by Sn, that are this cohomology group. See, this is one really good reason, too, to study ordered points, because for ordered points, all the information, this is true for any degree of cohomology, so all the information about the cohomology of the space of unordered n-tuples on a manifold, you should look at the space of all ordered tuples, and then the cohomology is appearing there, it's just the fixed vectors, but there's lots more interesting stuff. So it's the fixed vectors, and then I just, easy exercise, which I gave to my undergraduates, the exercise is, so here's the action, I just said here's the action. Just from representation theory, with this action, I have a Sn acting on a vector space spanned by the wijs. I just specified to you the action. Tell me what the vectors are that are fixed. And it's exactly multiples of this single vector. So that's the end of the proof. Okay? So that's a little baby version of how representation theory can be used to tell you something in topology. So as a recap, we were looking at how the topology changes on the space of unordered and ordered n-tuples just in the plane. Again, this story will end up being vastly more general, and we saw that for unordered tuples, it's one-dimensional. Now, this is a tiny special case of a much more general theorem of Arnold, and then Fred Cohen did the case with integer coefficients. For any I greater than or equal to 0, the cohomology of the space of unordered n-tuples doesn't depend on n for n greater than, for n sufficiently large, depending on I. And of course, you see that up here. I said it's for I. I guess this isn't that exciting. It's n greater than or equal to 2. So it stabilizes at 2. And then it doesn't change. But this phenomenon happens in general. And this is what's called homological stability. If you want to understand a sequence of spaces, you want to understand their homology or cohomology, you try to relate them, and you try to prove something like this kind of statement. Because what this kind of statement does, it converts an infinite set of questions, like what is the second homology, cohomology of the space of polynomials, where n is changing, that's infinitely many questions. If you know it doesn't depend, and you know the explicit bound on this range, it reduces to finitely many questions, right? If it stabilizes starting at n is 3, then I only have to compute for n equals 1, 2, and 3. Now, we just saw this is false. There's instability when you have ordered n tuples. We just saw that it depends on n. The first cohomology depends on n. And in fact, you can prove that the ith cohomology for any I, always the dimension goes to infinity. It's the opposite of homological stability. It's homological instability. And what's happening here? Well, what's happening is the following. As I said, the symmetric group is acting on configurations of points in the plane, so it acts on the cohomology. Now, it's a basic fact. What's a basic fact is if you have a vector space with a non-trivial SN action. So what I mean by that is, suppose you have a vector space, the symmetric group is acting by linear maps, and suppose every element of the symmetric group, either all the eigenvalues are plus or minus 1. You're big boys and girls. Every vector either is here, yeah, plus or minus 1. That's trivial. So apart from trivial stuff, as long as you know that, you go look up in any basic representation theory book, and they'll list out sort of what the representations of the symmetric group can be. And you just, like, look it up. You don't have to know any topology. And it has to be at least dimension n minus 1. And therefore, the dimension has to go to infinity with n, because it has to be at least dimension n minus 1. So the theme here is, whenever you have symmetry in a situation like the symmetric group acting, you'll never have any kind of stability. But somehow, morally, you do have, we saw for like H1, this is the entire reason for the instability comes from the representation theory. Because we looked at the Wijs, and there's only one of them. There's only how number 1 wraps around number 2, right? W12. Everything else is just changing the names of the points. So how do you encode that? How do you formalize that? So that's this theory that Tom Church and Jordan Ellenby have been working on. The first generation was called representation stability. So let me tell you about that. And I'll mention the second generation. OK, so here's representation theory in one slide. I do need to tell you some very basic things, to remind you of very basic things. By a representation, I just mean a vector space over Q with an action by matrices of a group. And it's irreducible if there are no invariant subspaces, except obviously the zero subspace in the whole thing. So these are like the atoms, the irreducible representations. And Moschke's theorem says that like every representation of a finite group, it's a direct sum of irreducible ones. So everything is made up of just a sum of atoms. And so, for example, if you want to know what the matrices are, like what their traces are, what their eigenvalues, you may as well just try to look at irreducible ones and figure out them. So in general, the goals of representation theory, two of the main goals. Firstly, if you give me a group, classify all of its irreducible representations. There's always finitely many. So figure out the atoms. And then in nature, and we'll see what I mean by in nature, if you give me a representation, how do I decompose it into irreducibles? So a common thing, if you take like a tensor product of two irreducibles, it's no longer irreducible. So how do you decompose it? There's a whole like area in mathematics that studies that. OK. So for the symmetric group, the representation theory is very rich, and it's well known. And it goes back to Reverend Young in 1900. And he gave a natural bijection from irreducible representations of the symmetric group on n letters with partitions of n. And I can't describe what all of the irreducible representations are and what his coding system is, but I just want to tell you a few little hints, a few examples, because it's too involved. So the trivial representation, that is Q is a one-dimensional vector space, and the symmetric group acts on it by the identity matrix. And that is an irreducible representation because there's no invariant subspaces, right? Because there's no subspaces. apart from zero in the whole thing. And so the trivial, that's called the trivial rep. It's one by one matrices. And that corresponds to the partition N. The standard representation, so look at Q to the N, n-dimensional vector space. The symmetric group acts by permuting the coordinate axes, right? By permuting the coordinates. That is not irreducible. It fixes the vector 1, 1, 1, 1, the span of 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, right? If all your coordinates are equal, the whole symmetric group is not going to change. It's going to fix all those things. So you fix 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, exercise, which is a fun exercise. If you look at the hyperplane to that, so therefore you leave invariant the hyperplane. If you leave invariant, you can make it leave invariant the standard inner product. That's an n minus one dimensional vector space, and guess what? That's irreducible. So it's an n minus one dimensional irreducible representation, and it corresponds to this partition, n minus one plus one. Oh, whoops, this should be in Q to the n. Thank you. Thank you. Right there, that should be Q to the n. Thanks, all. I can now take wedge 3 of the standard representation, just things of the form x, wedge y, wedge z, where x, y, and z are in this n minus 1 dimensional vector space. And I obviously, I act, how does a matrix act on x, wedge y, wedge z? You just act on x and y and z and wedge them. And that corresponds to this. These things get a little complicated, right? Like what's the trade, you know, just saying. So I want to use notation due to Murnaghan from 1937, his theory of like padded partitions. I don't want to, why say n? Because it depends on n. N depends on n, but trivial doesn't depend on n. So here's a way, given a partition of any number, I'm going to produce an irreducible representation for all sufficiently large symmetric groups. And I'll just say, look, if you give me a partition like 0, of the number 0, I get a partition of n by just adding what I need to add to make it n. So like the partition 1 plus 1 plus 1, if I want a partition of n, I have to add n minus 3. So v of 1, 1, 1 will denote, if you're looking at the symmetric group on n letters, v of 1, 1, 1 will denote that irreducible representation in Young's system corresponding to this partition. Okay? Questions? Okay. It's just this naming system. Back, let's look at the cohomology of configurations of points again in the plane. By the way, what I'm hoping to show in this talk, again, I'm going to the simplest example. I'm hoping to show it's like rich enough to do a whole talk on and to spend some years on. But like, there's of course, this is the tiniest, tiniest little speck of, but most of the other stuff is unknown. I'm not saying that because, like, look how great we are. We did these, all these things. It's because this is the thing about which we know the most. And I think there's a lot that we don't know. Most of the things we don't know. We're mostly ignorant. Okay, so back to configuration spaces. Why did I do all that rep theory? Well, what it says is the following. If you take any vector space, any representation of the symmetric group, right? The left-hand side is a representation of the symmetric group, Sn axe. So it's a direct sum of irreducibles. So I'm taking it's a direct sum of irreducibles. This just means take this many copies. This number can be 0. In fact, if the left-hand side is finite dimensional, the right-hand side will be 0 for all but finitely many. So if you fix n and fix I and fix n, you get these numbers. Okay? What I love about this, it just like pops out. I'm just like looking at points in the plane moving around, n points, and I look at fix I, and then for each n I get this like list of partitions. This list of, these are called multiplicities. So this is what I want to understand. And I hope to show you that this is worth understanding. It's an old problem going back to Breezecorn and Richard Stanley studied this and Orlick and Larry Solomon. Find these numbers. Just, they've been working on it just for C. And by the way, we definitely do not know these numbers even for C. I would say there's still things to learn about these numbers. But now if you plug in, instead of C, plug in genus 2 surface. I would say we do not know those numbers. Yeah. You have to find patterns. But I want to demonstrate to you today, these encode a huge amount of structure and meaning. Today I'm going to talk about geometric meaning and arithmetic meaning. That it's like a worthy thing to try to understand. So here's an example. this first cohomology we already saw and understood this. I want to revisit it again. Bill's telling it is a Bill thing. Like, revisit it again. We've got to level 5. I want to do level 8 now. Before, I just said this is a naked vector space of dimension n choose 2. But much more interesting is, OK, the symmetric group is acting. How does it act? What is the, in terms of irreducible representations? So here's what it is. By the way, this is only for n greater than equal to 4. So let me figure out what this means, what the geometric meaning. This means for any n at least 4, this vector space is literally, this was the trivial representation. So this is a one-dimensional piece. This is the standard representation. That's an n minus one-dimensional piece. And this is, I don't know what this is. It's hard to, you'll see. OK? And the symmetric group acts, it leaves invariant each piece. And they have meaning. So let's try to make pretend, let me try to pick out geometric meaning. Let's pretend we don't know anything about geometry or topology, since we're at a GeomTop conference. No, but I mean, in this case. So my claim is that these things should have, by the nature of math, these things should have geometric meaning, these actual irreducible pieces. So let's find the geometric meaning. What is the geometric meaning of this fixed vector? I said before, it's the trivial representation. What does that mean? That's the set of vectors that are fixed. What does that mean? What is the set of vectors that are fixed? I can just give you those Wijs like I gave to my undergraduates. It's an easy exercise. What are the fixed vectors? There, it's only this, and it's multiples of this vector. Guess what? That's total winding number. We just discovered the invariant. Let's look at this next one. A little more meaningful than each piece is, let me look at the sum of the two. Trivial plus the standard, by construction, this is just the usual permutation representation on q to the n. In other words, v0 plus v1, purely algebraically, is just permuting the coordinate axes in q to the n. But what is the meaning? I mean, somewhere in this cohomology group, this is what you don't know. Somewhere in this cohomology group, I should be able to find n vectors, u1 to un, that are permuted when I change the names of the labeled points. Remember, when my action is like I'm labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. When I change the name of the points, there's some cohomology vectors that are permuted. I should be able to find n of them. So give me, we have to find n invariants. What are these? These are invariants that attach to every loop a number. Okay? Give me n ways of doing that, u1 to un, which when I change the name from number 1 to number 5, it takes it from u1 to u5. Any guesses if you haven't seen it before? Like, what should u1 be? Thurston student right there. Here's what it is, what Rick just said. Here's the thing, ready? You fix I, and then you just take the total winding of everybody else around I. Right? That's some total winding number around I. That changes when you change names. But here's how it changes. If I change my name from I to J, it takes it to UJ. So I'm just saying we sort of found those geometric things. Finally, the whole thing, if we didn't know this like a winding number thing, you could say, oh, it's V0 plus V1 plus V2. That's the permutations on two-element subsets. We should try to do something with pairs of elements. And you could rediscover the Wijs. So anyway, this is a simple, incredibly simplest example of the first cohomology. And it already, I think, is reasonably interesting. So the start of our my path in this direction with Tom Church, he was my student. We were talking about math. And we sort of had this guess for various reasons, for more of like blind hope, that like we wanted to know what happens for H2. So for the first cohomology, I told you, for n at least 4, the first cohomology of space of configurations is v of 0 plus v of 1 plus v of 2. So notice that that the right side doesn't depend on n. So it's a long story, but we, with help from David Hemmer, who programmed on the computer and proved some a key result for us in rep theory, we asked, what is H2 of configurations of endpoints? I called it C sub n just to make it save room. So you can do it on a computer. You can convert it to a pure algebra problem. So this vector space is just V of 1, which means the standard And so computer spitting out this, and what we had conjectured, Tom and I had hoped, was that the names of the you're unstable. So when you say V of 1, let me just point this out. V of 1 has dimension n minus 1. So homological stability doesn't hold. But we were hoping that the stability is just, we called it representation stability, that like the names of the representation doesn't change for n big enough. We're like, oh, this is so beautiful. It's got to be true. And the computer came back to us like, yep, it's changing, different. Actually, it's even more exciting. That should be 1. Changing. And it got more and more complicated. And Hemmer was like, sorry, guys, this does not work. It's not true. And it's a bit of a story, but it has to do with the fact that the outer automorphism group of S6 is not trivial. Really cool thing. And the coding and gap, there was a mislabeling. And when you account for that, the computer started to spit out, you know, no stability. It's like, you're wrong. It spat out for n equals 8, 9, 10. It just kept spitting out the same line. So that's a stability. The dimension, so for all n at least 7, and 7 is sharp, this is stable. There it is. I just wrote this. The dimensions are going up, but I can tell you everything about these things because I know it is a representation. And in fact, we were able to prove this in 2010 that you have to fix the degree of cohomology. Then you look at the ith cohomology. Later, with other people, there's characteristic P. There's a whole big theory. But this first case was just that does stabilize, and it's true in all degrees. Namely, when you write your thing as a direct sum, you write your cohomology group as a direct sum of irreducible representations, the names of the representations don't depend on n for n at least 4i. For n at least 4i, which isn't quite sharp because it predicts for degree 2 that it stabilizes at 8. And we saw it stabilized at 7. And actually, we just got an email 2 days ago from 2 people in algebraic combinatorics, because our work applies to and touches on, in a big way, algebraic combinatorics, which I don't have time to talk about today. But Patricia Hirsch and Vic Reiner just told us they believe they can get this down to 3i plus 1, which is pretty cool. And they said, is this interesting? And we're like, that's sharp. We think that's sharp. And so anyway, there's a minor generalization of this theorem from the plane to all manifolds. I consider it minor. It was some guy. Oh, yeah, Church. And then later, it was lots of other people. We improved in little ways. But anyway, so Tom did, in a great paper, generalized it to all things. And let me just say one application of this, purely outside the field. McDuff and Siegel, in very famous work from the 70s, proved that if you have a manifold with boundary, with non-empty boundary, the interior of a compact manifold with non-empty boundary, classical homological stability holds for spaces of unordered points, configurations of unordered distinct points. Now, it turns out it just, and they do it by having maps between the spaces. You use the boundary to get maps between the spaces. But if you're in a closed manifold, like nobody knew like what happens for like the torus. Like, ready? Give me a map from 5 points on the torus to 4. Unordered. You can't name it. See, if you order the points 1 through 5, there's a map. Forget number 5, or forget number 3, or forget number 2. And you're like, great, I'll just like look at ordered points. I'll take finite covers. I'll look at the space of ordered points. It's like, yeah, but then stability fails. And you'll like walk away. But let me say this. They're very smart people. They would have noticed this. And so what happens is, since they're serious topologists, they did it over Z. And over Z, homological stability, even if you put in the two-sphere and look at unordered points on the two-sphere, homological stability fails. But with this representation stability that Tom proved, if you plug in the trivial representation, then with rational coefficients, that's when you plug in the trivial representation to Tom's theorem, this with an M, what that says is that the homology of the space of unordered n-tuples stabilizes rationally, even though there's not maps between them. So to me, this was the first real victory of our theory, because it's a completely new kind of stability outside the area. We didn't even know it for the torus. He told me something new about the torus. And you never would have discovered it without this. And then, I'm going to forget the names. Oscar Randall Williams, and then like three other groups of algebraic topologists then proved it without rep stability. But he only plugged in the trivial rep to get that. Anyway, sorry, let me move on. The answers, though, I should warn you, are complicated. By the way, Tom Church worked this out by hand. This is what happens when you have a 19-year-old with lots of time, or who's fast. And what's cool is this only kicks in for at least 16, and Patricia and Vic just proved it's like for 13, and we think that's sharp. So it's pretty cool. Like, this is the answer, but like in the beginning when n is small, so really you need it to stabilize. But each of these things I claim has like meaning, and it has to be that way, and I'll try to show you why by the end of the talk. Okay. The second generation of this work, that's where we were, and Jordan Ellenberg joined us. He was trying to understand our work. He's a number theorist. And I don't have time to tell you, but I want to say what our theory does. It's our second paper called like FI modules, ... And it's a complete rephrasing of this kind of stability phenomenon. It's so much more powerful, and it gave really new applications. And let me just tell you what it does. It replaces, before we had like a sequence of representations of the symmetric group, right? So it's all these things and maps between them. It just replaces it with a single mathematical object. It happens to be a functor from the category of finite sets and injections to like R modules where R is a Noetherian ring. It doesn't matter. It's a single math object, V. And this thing about the multiplicities and they stabilize, it's just converted. This is really an if and only. It's converted to just a single object is finitely generated. Hey, we're used to that. And in fact, just calling it module, once you hear the word module, that's a huge jump right there, because now if you're like, that's the right thing to call it. So like you have quotients, you can just take the tensor product. It's weird. Try to take like the tensor, well, it's not that. But and you have a Noetherian condition. There's a whole theory of like modules. And each individual object, though, is this whole sequence is replaced by one object. So here's, I think, a great exhibit of the power of just the power of point of view of this theory. Murnaghan's really famous theorem from 1937, which was actually just proved in the 50s. And that proof, actually, people say it's just proved in the 70s, but whatever. If you know it, you know it. If you don't, you know it. Murnaghan's theorem is about coefficient stabilizing when you just take the tensor product of two irreducible representations of the symmetric group. Purely representation theory theorem. He proved basically representation stability, something like that. Ready? Here's a one-line proof of Murnaghan's theorem. When you have finitely generated modules, their tensor product is finitely generated. Done. I mean, you're not supposed to see why this implies, but I'm just saying that's like in the theory, that's the proof. Now, let me give you sample application of the theory, what this kind of theory gives you, because this is where a lot of open questions are. So here's a theorem. The first two things are by Church and Ellenberg and me, and then my former student, Rita Jimenez-Roland, did number three. So I just picked three random examples of all the examples. Take one of the following, HI of configuration spaces of a manifold. Here's something from algebraic geometry. Look at the space of polynomials. You look at the variety of n by n matrices whose rank is at most some fixed number, d. These are called rank varieties. And you can look at polynomials on those, degree I polynomials. So you're fixing I and d and letting n get big. That's a really cool space, well-studied space. Another thing you can do, and again, if you don't know these examples, doesn't matter, just examples. Moduli space of genus G Riemann surfaces with n marked points. Now, secretly, the symmetric group, not so secretly, Sn acts on all three of these things. But here's what the general theory gives as applications sort of outside the theory. Firstly, by the way, these vector spaces, they're almost universally, I would say, we don't actually know the Vn's, what they are. We don't know their dimensions or anything. We do in special cases, like configurations in Rn. Or sorry, R to the D or something. But we don't know it for like genus G surface. I think Melanie Wood maybe just figured that out. But. So we don't know any of these things, but this answers it for all of them. But we don't know. So the dimension is polynomial, not growth. It equals dead on a polynomial for n sufficiently large. And we can have bounds on the n, degrees of polynomial, but we don't know what the polynomials are. So that's the big. And just for people who know rep theory, it's a much stronger thing. The characters. So A is B, where you plug in the identity permutation. But there, one, to me, exciting aspect was we sort of rediscovered these things due to Percy Diaconus, who actually had rediscovered them, they're due to Frobenius from 100 years ago. These things called character polynomials. And the characters of these things are polynomial. But anyway, I just want to say, if you don't know that, that's fine. But to me, the main open problem that I'm interested in is find these polynomials, because we know them in almost no cases. Okay? And they have all this meaning, as I will show. We saw some of the geometric meaning earlier. Finding the polynomials is a cleaner way of finding all those multiplicities. Okay. Finally, in the last part of my talk, I'm going back again to the easy example. One more layer of meaning. And I want to see a reflection of what I've been talking about, just the configuration of the points on the plane in number theory. And yeah, here's a quote by Bill in his Proof in Progress, where he crushes Jaffe and Quinn so brutally in such a nice way. I would have been much more, he's a classy guy. Bill is a classy guy. But he just totally destroyed them in that paper. Sorry, I mean. They were speaking out of school. They were speaking out of school. In writing. I do it all the time, but don't do it in writing. Anyway, yeah, I also coming back to revisit the different concept with added meaning. So I'm going to go one more layer here. So let me recap what we know. We've got the space of polynomials. It's covered by the space of ordered n tuples. Symmetric group is the Dec group. We have access to these cohomology groups as representations. Namely, yeah, this is the sum of irreducibles. They stabilize. Every computation becomes finite. And if you have Tom as a collaborator, you can actually compute them. And a computer can do it, by the way, in principle. Oh, sorry. Yeah, exactly. You said. But you have to program that computer. By transfer, another way, let me just rephrase this. In this case, you can access HI of the space of unordered points with twisted coefficients. If you don't know what that is, that's fine. These are like equivalent. What I want to know is, great, we're doing these things in topology. I gave some geometric meaning. But you know what? We're talking about polynomials. So like, what can you say about, give me some polynomial. You know, it's like, what can you actually say about a polynomial? Can we leverage this? And that's what I want to do. So I learned this method, I think, from Kurt McMullen. You know, when you're stuck, what do? You go, what would Bill do? And of course, it never works. If it worked, if you knew that, if you knew it, you'd already have proven a much better theorem than you will ever prove. But what would Bill do? Now I just say, what would Danny do? No. Okay, so here's what Bill would do. Oh, sorry, let me not mention. Here's what Bill would do. He would say, okay, Farmchurch and Ellenberg, you understand the topology of this space reasonably well. But now let's look at a dynamical system on that space. So let's look at our space. Okay, I'm switching gears a little. Don't freak out, but let's look at polynomials over the algebraic closure of FQ. Just pretend it's C for a second. You have the Frobenius map that just takes x goes to x to the q. Okay. Q is a prime. It acts on this space, this variety. And you can think of this like a surface and a diffeomorphism. And you'd go, always look for fixed point. By the way, my wife, that picture of Bill doesn't exist. My wife like photoshopped in this hand. She said, no, this is good. And I thought, is this, and it's like, no, Bill would appreciate this. Always look for fixed points, right? You have a dynamical system here. Let's look for a fixed point. And Andre Vey. It's like, that's what I did, dude. I already was there before you, before Thurston. That's what Andre Vey did. And his great observation, which I guess was really Hasse, or it was earlier than Andre Vey, but he really was the guy who advertised it the most, and therefore he gets the thing. Vey's great observation is the following. If I care about, so poly n of C, the space of polynomials was an algebraic variety. You can look at the FQ points, and guess what? That's a space of monic, degree n, square-free polynomials over FQ. How many are there? How many square-free polynomials are there over FQ, degree n? Well, I mean, that's elementary. You can do it. But the key thing here I want to tell you about is this kind of connection with topology. It's the bridge that's interesting, not the answer to how many things are in this or whatever. Well, look, you're acting on poly n fq bar. Frobenius is x go to x to the q. What are the fixed points? The fixed points are the set of numbers where x is congruent to x to the q, mod q. Fermat's little theorem gives you all the solutions to that. It's exactly the things in fq. It gives you solutions, and then x to the q minus x is degree q, and so those are all of them. You know you have q roots. So it's like, wait, we can do counts of fq points, of solutions to equations, of fq points in algebraic varieties by looking for fixed points of Frobenius. Gee, what should you do? Well, this is another kind of common thing. Let's apply the Lefschetz fixed point theorem and see what it says. Right? That's how you compute the number of fixed points, if you know the index of the fixed points. Let's assume everything is index 1. So that means like the number of fixed points of like a diffeomorphism, like Frob of Q, or a morphism. It's the alternating sum of traces of your map on cohomology, right? This is great. I'm going to be able to compute stuff because cohomology, remember, this is cohomology of the space of polynomials, which I apparently have access to. The problem is that this is all meaningless because this space is some weird, totally disconnected, you know, space, and like Frobenius isn't like, is it continuous? Like, what cohomology am I talking about? A cohomology of a totally disconnected space. But what these wacky guys, this wacky guy Grothendieck, no, what Grothendieck, Grothendieck-Lefschetz fixed-point theorem, what a tall cohomology is about, it makes sense of this equation. And this becomes a tall cohomology, but at the end of the day, you really care about, it's a long story that I don't have time to tell. It's an incredible story due to Grothendieck and Lefschetz and and Vey and Deligne, et cetera. But what it does, what this theory does, what a tall cohomology does, it gives you, and I'm going to do it more generally, you can have twisted cohomology, but the input, you tell me the dimension of cohomology with twisted coefficients, which remember before, it's the same thing as saying, like, what's the multiplicity of V in the cohomology of configurations? And it converts it, because you know, see, there's cohomology there. So somehow, if I know cohomology groups of the complex points, amazingly, you get things about the number of points, so different point counts. And this twisted coefficient thing comes in. In other words, I'm not just putting Q here. If I put in, well, the twisted thing comes in to give me different kinds of point counts. So let me be very concrete about what I mean by that. So by the way, though, but this fits in really well to what I just talked about earlier in this talk. Why? Because we have access to this side. That's exactly the meat. We said that this dimension stabilizes for n large. You fix I, this dimension stabilizes for n large, so like any point count you want. We have like a meta theorem that says any way of counting polynomials in a reasonable way. Yeah, so let me just give some examples. Boing, there's the dictionary. Okay, when you plug in the trivial representation to what I just said. So again, for every V, I plug in a V, I'm going to get a theorem about counting polynomials. And by the way, Bill's last paper, which I think we might hear about before this conference is over, Bill was definitely studying polynomials and counting polynomials over C, but he definitely thought about over FQ as well. So I feel this is close to things he was interested in. So when you plug in the trivial so what this is, it's a machine now for given the left side, which is exactly what we proved is stable, and we have access to computing the left side. It produces a theorem in number theory. Okay? And here's how the correspondence works. Some examples of the correspondence. When you plug in the trivial representation, meaning how many times, well, just plug in V0 to this, you get the count for the number of polynomials of degree n, square free polynomials degree n over FQ. When you plug in the standard permutation representation, you can compute this with our theory. And it pops out that, like, you say, what is the expected number of linear factors? You take a polynomial. Oh, I shouldn't call it linear factors. How many roots? If you give me a polynomial over FQ, how many of the roots lie in FQ? Some do, some don't. It's like, right, degree 3, you either have like 0, 1, or 2 roots. And right? Some things don't lie in. And what's the expected number? It's less than 1. And that's the exact number. And one cool thing is that when you write down the exact answers, which you can do, do it for Q is 3, 4, 5, degree 2, 3, 4, 5. What you start to see, it's so cool, you have these power series, you know, just for like degree 2 polynomials, the number is like 1 minus 1 over Q plus 1 over Q squared. Degree 3, oh, I might be off. It's 1 minus 1 over Q plus 1 over Q. And other counts, you see these things starting to converge. And on this side, this stability that I've been talking about this whole talk, we said these numbers stabilize, and we even have a stable range for them when they start to stabilize. What you get as a corollary from that is that any count like this, and we have a third paper called Counting Points and Varieties, blah, blah, blah. Now, you can solve some of these. What it says is that since this stabilizes, a very general counting problem, like what do you expect the typical polynomial of degree n? How many quadratic factors do you expect, irreducibles? What is the 15th moment of that? Now, what is, you know, the sum of the 15th power? It's a huge array of problems. And they all, the answers are like literally, they converge to a formal power series as the degree gets bigger. That's a corollary. And what's neat is, in this very special case, the bridge goes the other way, and you could have proved representation stability for the cohomology of configuration space if you're really good at computing the right-hand side in number theory, which you have to know L functions and stuff. And I'm not sure how general, but you know. And secondly, solves the mystery. That was, anyway. Finally, let me just, the thing I think is very cool is that the stable range. So when does this start to stabilize? The stable range actually has to do with the rate of convergence to the right side. So it's in other words, if your stable range is like linear with constant c, the rate of convergence of this thing to the formal power series, it's like the cth root of 1 over q. So that I think is very cool because I haven't seen like stable range. The actual numbers really matter so much. Okay, so that's the body of the talk. And I want to share an email from Bill from 1998 when I wasn't doing anything like this stuff. And Bill was emailing me asking about, he was talking about geometric group theory, and I was working on quasi-symmetries, giving new proofs of Mostow rigidity, and he was saying, can you prove super-rigidity and all this stuff. And he said this, some of the different approaches to analyzing groups deserve to be reconciled better. For example, representations, which seem pretty important to finite groups, don't seem to have much role in geometric group theory. So one thing that I would say to a lot of people here doing geometric group theory, including me, it's true. There's like geometric group theory, and then there's like representation theory, where you're acting linearly and not by symmetries, but it's matrices. Like those two things are almost disjoint. I would go so far as to say it's incredible. And so today's talk you could view as one example of like bringing in, of course, representation theory has appeared in topology for 80 years, 90 years. But I think in this kind of, anyway, I'll let Bill's thing speak for itself. And finally, I want to remind us before we go, at least we'll go today, we can remind us with this other fantastic quote from Bill. We may think we know all there is to say about a certain subject, but new insights are around the corner. It's always good to remember, so I'll end on that. Yes.
You're missing something about the ring structure of homology in terms of representation.
No, not yet. The question was, can you say something about the ring structure? Because now we're just looking at the additive structure. Right, that's a whole other level. And there seem to be patterns. But yeah. Yeah, that's a great note. It's definitely a great direction. Yeah. And in fact, I just mentioned the ring structure is what Smale used. Smale used this cohomology that we've been studying. He used the ring structure to show that, like, give a lower bound on the complexity of finding roots of polynomials. Like, suppose you want to find roots of a degree n polynomial, like, just within epsilon, right? He says it's, like, pretty hard. And he uses the fact that the ring structure, yeah. So it must have lots of meaning. Therefore, it must have lots of meaning. Yeah. Yes?
Can you say something proving the unsolvability of the braid?
Oh, yeah. The question is the unsolvability of the quintic with braids. I can, like, right after the talk. If I tried to do it now, it would be too long. But I'll just say this. What you realize is that, OK, I guess who was asking this before? I guess Rick was asking this in his talk. How different is the proof from the Galois theory proof? I mean, somehow it has to be. But the idea is, how do you show you can't solve the quintic? Solving the quintic by radicals, or solving a sextic or whatever, by radicals means I can write an equation in terms of the coefficients, right, like square root of b squared minus 4c, et cetera. That gives me a map from this space of polynomials parameterized by the coefficients. Let's just restrict to square free. You can do that. It would give me, and it gives me a map to, like, the roots. And it's that map has to have certain topological properties. But then you know certain things about the cohomology. And you say, oh, that map. And if you're solvable by radicals, you look, that map on pi 1, the image has to be, like, solvable. But then there's a permutation group. It's like the Sn is not solvable for n at least 5. So in some sense, it's sort of like, but I think it's different. Yeah, it's really awesome. Yeah. And this is not so far from Hilbert's 13th problem, which I can talk about later. Yeah. Which seems to be a purely, like, Russian pastime. But it's awesome stuff. When you get into those papers, it's totally awesome. If you can figure out what the hell they're saying, it's taken me years, and I'm like, oh my god, that's what they're saying. Yeah.
Does this suggest anything about Matthew space and subgroup space? Because we can think of Sn as, like, Sn minus 1 is a subgroup of Sn.
Yes.
This kind of induced. So there's a induced argument starting from, like, a representation of Sn minus 1 linked to Sn.
Yes, that's very good. If you look in our paper, this theory of FI modules, and I should say, there's a related theory. Whoops, should always plug your, he's a former student, screw him. When you're a former student, you don't have to. Andy Putman has a related notion, and this comes up then in our theory too with these FI modules. You can phrase things sort of in terms of induced representations. Like you have these vector spaces at stage n minus 1, and then a vector space at stage n. And you have Sn as n minus 1 is acting, and Sn is acting. And there's a way to try to rephrase things and relate it very closely to induced representation. It's like saying you're a quotient of a sum of induced, you know.